Okay, I want to talk now a little bit about gag orders. As I said earlier, gag orders are generally speaking unconstitutional. We know that from Neer versus Minnesota, and we also now will know that from Nebraska Press Association versus Stewart. This is probably the most important case in the entire Chapter 7, although there are plenty of other cases in this chapter. This is the case that really set the tone about gag orders and the limits of the court to be able to tell the media not to write about something. Here are the facts. That gentleman there in the corner is Hugh Stewart. He got the unenviable task of having to manage the trial of a guy named Erwin Charles Simons, or Simmons. I think it's Simons. This gentleman, who had an IQ of in the 80s or 90s, I believe, not a very smart guy, murdered six members of the Henry Kelly family in the little tiny town of Sutherland, Nebraska. The 10-year-old girl and the grandma had been raped after they died. Simons turned himself in and said that he heard voices in his head. Clearly, the guy's not all there. So Hugh Stewart, the judge, gets the case, and he thinks, this is going to be a very high-profile trial. What can I do to make sure that Simons gets a fair trial? I know, I'll gag the media. So that's what he does. He writes a restrictive order that is relating to matters that may or may not be publicly reported or disclosed to the media because of mass coverage by the news media and the reasonable likelihood of prejudicial news which would make difficult, if not impossible, the impaneling of an impartial jury, intent to prevent a fair trial. So what Stewart does is he tells the news media, you cannot publish anything about this case because I need to be sure that Simons gets a fair trial, and if you guys publish stuff about this case, people are going to be biased against him. Well, the Nebraska Press Association, like all other state press associations, has a fit about this. They appeal to the Nebraska Supreme Court, which upholds the gag order, and then they appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, sorry, Judge Stewart, you can't do this. Gag orders are a form of prior restraint. We presume that they are unconstitutional on their face, but we give you a three-part test to meet, and it's a very tough standard. Okay? Notice the little orange doohickey in the corner that says test, so it's a three-part legal test, and it will be on the test. The government has the burden of proof, and the government must demonstrate the following three areas. First, the government has to show, through evidence, that the nature and extent of pretrial publicity would impair the defendant's right to a fair trial. So the government has to show evidence that there's going to be so much coverage of this case that there's no way that a defendant can get a fair trial. The second thing that the government must show is that there are no alternative measures which could mitigate the effects of the publicity. So in other words, that entire laundry list that the Shepherd Court provided, you know, voir dire, better voir dire, and sequestering, and continuances, and change of venue, none of those will work. So the judge has to basically argue, the government has to argue, I thought about all those things, and none of them will work. And, more importantly, or perhaps most importantly, a prior restraint will effectively prevent the harm. So in other words, the judge has to basically gaze into his or her crystal ball and say, if I gag the media, the defendant will absolutely get a fair trial. And as you might guess, that's a tough burden to meet. So, 99 times out of 100, a gag order will be overturned when this test is applied to it. Okay? The court basically said that judges have to deal with this publicity because the First Amendment permits the media to cover trials without, you know, impinging upon the defendant's rights. It's up to the judge to do his or her job well so that the media gets sufficient access and the defendant gets a fair trial. It's not an easy job to do. But as a result of Nebraska Press Association, valid gag orders are rare. Prior restraints, in fact, according to three justices on this court, were always unconstitutional. But the test is what stands here, and you will be asked to understand the test on an exam. Okay, so students always ask me what happens to Simons, what happened to him. Last time I checked, a couple years ago, he was still serving time in a state mental health center. His original conviction was overturned, but again, on retrial, he was convicted, found not guilty by reason of insanity. We would call it disease or defect now, and he's still in jail somewhere in Nebraska. So you do need to understand the test in Nebraska Press Association and be able to apply it. Okay. Now, there are a couple of different understandings of whether or not you should obey a gag order. We know from Nebraska Press Association and Near versus Minnesota that valid gag orders are actually rare. So some media organizations have said, well, you know, we're not even going to obey a gag order because we know it's going to be overturned, so why should we waste our time appealing it? And there are two conflicting views, and I'm going to give you a recommendation on what I think, based on my reading of the law, you should do. In the Fifth Circuit, the pretrial hearing was gagged in a case, and the reporters published anyway. The Fifth Circuit said that the order was invalid, but reporters had to obey anyway. Okay? So in other words, they disobeyed the law in the Fifth Circuit. Probably not the world's best idea. In Re Providence Journal, the court said that the journal is entitled to disregard the order, but again, it fails on its face. They can disregard the order. The First Circuit says this. Okay? So the Fifth Circuit is saying, you must obey, you must obey, you must obey. The First Circuit says, if it's obviously invalid, you don't have to obey. The Supreme Court has never definitively told us. However, they did hear oral argument in the Providence Journal case, and they were leaning very heavily against the Providence Journal's decision to ignore the order. So it is my recommendation, as well as the Supreme Court's tacit recommendation, that you obey a gag order if it's slapped on you and appeal it quickly. Don't just assume that it's going to be overturned and disobey it to save time. Go through the legal proceedings that are necessary to basically get the gag order overturned. So essentially, you should obey the Fifth Circuit. You should obey the Dickinson case, the outcome. The reporters must obey gag orders, even if they believe them to be unconstitutional. Okay. Let's talk about gagging trial participants. The courts have said and have upheld that it is easier and should be easier to gag participants in the trial than it should be to gag the media. And the case is Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada. It's a lawyer case. Okay, so this attorney held a press conference talking about how a Vegas detective really should have been the one held accountable rather than his client. He got slapped with censures by the State Bar Association. But the Supreme Court overturns it and basically said, look, it should be easier and we're going to permit it to be easier to tell participants in the trial that they should not speak to the media. The court said the speech of lawyers representing clients in pending cases may be regulated under a less demanding standard than that established for regulation of the press. So in other words, judges are likely to uphold restrictions on trial participants more than they are likely to uphold gag orders on the press. I'll say that again. Judges are more likely to uphold restrictions on trial participants, like lawyers and witnesses, on them speaking to the media, than they are to restrict the press from speaking. It's a lower standard of proof. They don't have to meet Nebraska Press Association if it's just gagging a lawyer or gagging a witness. Okay? All right. Let's talk about access to judicial proceedings. We've talked about courtroom closures a little bit now, and I want to talk a little bit about these cases, or several cases in this. After Nebraska Press Association, the judges were not permitted to gag. Most of them were not okay. So judges were like, well, now what do? We have to still ensure that our defendants get fair trials. So how are we going to do this? Well, we know we'll close the courtroom. If the media can't see what's going on in the courtroom, they're not going to be able to write about it. And initially, the Supreme Court said that this was okay in a case called Gannett versus De Pasquale. It's a 1979 case, which becomes relevant in a minute. The court in this case said a Sixth Amendment guarantee for the defendant made it so that if a defendant wanted to, he or she could close the courtroom doors and not let anybody in. So if defendants have a Sixth Amendment right to close the courtroom if they want to, what do you suppose most defendants did? I know I would have done it if I had been a defendant in a criminal trial. You bet. They closed the courtroom doors. Okay? So the Supreme Court initially said, yeah, go ahead and shut those courtroom doors. Don't let anybody in. But as you might guess, the number of courtroom closings skyrocketed. Between 1979 and 1980, when the next case came down. So this rule was only a good rule for 1 year. Second most important case in the whole chapter, after Nebraska Press Association, is Richmond Newspapers versus Virginia. There was a murder case in Virginia, and the state kept trying it, and there were 4 mistrials, and finally the judge said, I can't deal with this anymore. We've got to have an outcome in this case. We're going to lock the trial to the public and the media. The newspapers objected. They said, well, we need to have access here. And the Supreme Court takes the case and says, remember that Gannett case we decided just a year ago when we said that the closure of the courtroom, you know, was a Sixth Amendment right of a defendant? Never mind. Courtrooms are open to the public as a matter of the First Amendment. Access to the actual trial is covered by the First Amendment. I'll say that again. Gannett case goes out the window, and access to the trial itself is guaranteed and mandated by the First Amendment. Okay? We hold that the right to attend criminal trials is implicit in the guarantees of the First Amendment. Without the freedom to attend such trials, which people have exercised for centuries, important aspects of freedom of speech and of the press could be eviscerated. Okay? Now, that doesn't open up the entire trial. We need some additional cases to do that. But Richmond newspapers opened up the actual trial itself to the public. So, Gannett no more. Richmond newspapers opens the trial. In the Globe newspaper case, the Supreme Court said that automatic closure of any proceeding is presumptively unconstitutional. In this case, the judge had closed part of a rape trial, and the Supreme Court said that a Massachusetts state law that required trial judges to close the courtrooms during certain times of a trial, particularly when minors were testifying, was unconstitutional. So any blanket law that mandates closure in all cases violates the First Amendment. Okay? And finally, we have the press enterprise cases. I'm going to call them PE1 and PE2. And in this case, both of these cases were brought by the press enterprise cases. If those of you have had Mel Opatowski for feature writing or another class, it was his newspaper, the Riverside Press Enterprise, that paid for these cases to go all the way to the Supreme Court. So we have a local celebrity teaching for us in this area of law. So next time you run into him in the hall, thank him for these cases, because they're really a critical part of our ability to access trials. Okay? Press Enterprise 1 says that the voir dire must be open, the jury selection must be open, and Press Enterprise 2 opens up the pretrial hearings. In Press Enterprise 1, the judge had closed jury selection in a teen girl's rape case, and in Press Enterprise 2, the preliminary hearing of a nurse accused of murdering his patients was closed. So again, to recap, Press Enterprise, we'll go back to the very beginning. The Gannett trial said, go ahead and close the courtroom. That was in 1979. In 1980, the court said, never mind. Richmond newspapers opens the actual trial. Press Enterprise 1 opens the voir dire. And Press Enterprise 2 opens the pretrial. I'll say that again. Richmond newspapers opens the trial. Press Enterprise 1 opens the jury selection, the voir dire. Press Enterprise 2 opens the pretrial hearings. And that's pretty much everything. And in fact, press enterprise cases have been used as precedent to open just about all kinds of proceedings before trials. Everything from bail hearings to sentencing to plea hearings to motions to testimony, all of that is now pretty much opened. And the judge has the burden of proof to demonstrate that there is a completely necessary need to close the hearings or the trial participants. Okay? And if the courtroom doors are closed, they can only stay closed for a short period of time, and then they must be opened again. For example, some courtrooms still like to close the courtroom when children are testifying. So what happens in these cases is that the courtroom is closed, the child comes on the stand, the child does the testimony, the child leaves the stand, the courtroom is opened. It's a very limited, narrow amount of time. So that's basically the state of the law in courtroom closings. Okay, so we've covered gag orders, we've covered courtroom closings. Court documents, the only thing I'm really going to say about them is that they are opened on a state-by-state basis. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit when we get into Chapter 9 about the openness of records. Judges, generally speaking, have to follow fairly strict rules on sealing court records, and there is a public right to know about what is in those court documents. But it's a state-by-state rule, and rather than trying to teach you all the state rules, I'll just say that when you move to Nebraska or Nevada or Montana or Washington, you need to find out what those rules are. All right, let's turn to the final area of courtroom access, and that is cameras in the courtroom. Historically, they haven't been permitted. However, that is starting now to break down. Okay? First case to address this at the Supreme Court level was a case called Estes versus Texas. Billy Saul Estes was convicted of murder. He argued that he had gotten an unfair trial because there had been cameras in his courtroom. And the Supreme Court kind of agreed with him. They said, well, take a look at the technology of 1960s cameras. They're big, they're bright, they're loud, they've got bright lights in the eyes of the people, they're big snaky cords, they're loud, they breathe a lot, all right? And they haven't been studied at all. The courts have not looked at how cameras in the courtroom will affect jurors, witnesses, testimony, the judge. None of this stuff has been studied yet. So we're going to err on the side of caution and say no cameras. All right? And that was good law for a couple of decades. Fast forward to 1981, when camera technology has gotten a lot smaller. Same side of sort of situation. Mr. Chandler argued that there had been a camera in his courtroom and he had gotten an unfair trial and the Estes case should rule. And the court said, well, let's look at the technology of cameras. We've started to study them a little bit. And now they're not as big. They're not as loud. They're not as intrusive. It is not automatic now that cameras in the courtroom result in an unfair trial. So the rule today is that even though there's no First Amendment right of access for cameras, it is up to the criminal defendant to prove that the cameras in the courtroom resulted in him getting a non-fair trial. So it's going to be up to the judge in most cases, although we're going to see that, you know, it's still not absolute. But just because there is a camera in the courtroom does not automatically assume that the defendant got an unfair trial. So now we love them. Okay, so it went from Estes saying no to Chandler saying basically maybe that it is up to the defendant to prove that the cameras resulted in an unfair trial. Okay, cameras in state and federal courts are still a little bit fussy. All states now permit some cameras in the courtroom. Sometimes they're still cameras, sometimes they're video cameras. All states provide some. But generally speaking, in the federal courts, we don't get to see them. In the early 1990s, the U.S. Judicial Conference had an experiment that allowed cameras in a couple of circuit courts and a couple of federal trial courts, and generally speaking, only in civil courts. You know, that went over okay, but there was no extension of the experiment. And pretty much now only the Second Circuit in New York and the Ninth Circuit permit here in California, permit there to be cameras in federal courts. Now, one of the things that Court TV, now True TV, has done is that it's been very active in trying to get additional cameras in courtrooms. They've really put a lot of time and money into lobbying these various judicial conferences for access to the courts. Okay? In the Twitter and YouTube, well, that's a mixed bag right now. Okay, some courts, kind of scattered all over the country, have allowed reporters to tweet. But how about recording for broadcast on YouTube? Not so fast. The Supreme Court this year, 2010, actually said that Judge Walker, who is now in the process of deciding the Prop 8 trial in San Francisco, had not followed the actual proper procedures to allow the Proposition 8 trial to be recorded and broadcast. So the Supreme Court is not willing at this point to say that we should allow all new technologies into the courtroom. Supreme Court has basically said we really have to study these things more. We have to be sure that all of the rules are followed. Okay? The unsigned opinion basically said, yeah, there might be some problems with allowing this production to take place because of the potential violence against supporters of Proposition 8. But Justice Breyer was not very happy about this, basically saying, you know, we shouldn't be sticking our nose into the Ninth Circuit's business. If they want to allow there to be cameras in any courtroom, we should be okay with that. Okay? So it's still an open question at the Supreme Court. And as for cameras in the Supreme Court, no, not right now. However, I used to say not in my lifetime, maybe. Justice Souter, who used to say things like, the day you see a camera coming into our courtroom, it's going to go roll over my dead body, is now gone. Chief Justice Roberts has been engaged in discussions with the Radio Television News Directors Association, RTNDA, to maybe allow it. And interestingly, Elena Kagan, who right now her vote is going toward the full Senate to be confirmed at the Supreme Court, has said she's all for cameras in the Supreme Court. So, you know, you never know. You never know. There are some very high-profile justices on the Supreme Court. Sonia Sotomayor just signed a deal to write a book. Justice Scalia has written extensively. Justice Thomas has written extensively. It's not necessarily out of the question. The argument has been that oral arguments are very complex. And if you ever listen to oral arguments or you ever read the transcripts, they're kind of complex. It's a difficult thing for a person who is not interested in the court and has not done research on the court to understand. And the argument has been that simply pulling sound bites out of context does not really serve the public's right to know. You know, one appeals court said the problem with televising arguments is that they can be edited, and if the public sees me giving a rough time to one lawyer, they think I'm biased. They don't see the whole picture, and they don't see me giving the same rough time to other lawyers. So given the constraints of local television news to need to edit down essentially into sound bites, the argument has been it's not really a fair picture. However, the New York Times has said, why don't we just have a court span the same way we have C-SPAN? Now, I'd be a dork and be glued to it, but I can see where other people might not be so interested. So right now, in a sense, the jury is still out. I used to say, not in my lifetime, but we're starting to see justices come on who might be interested in seeing televised Supreme Court arguments. All right. And so we've got Chapter 7.